This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Sports Radio 610 presents Seth Payne and Sean Pendergast.
We're coming to H-Town. Let's get their work in, man. Let's go.
Today, Abreu hits one high in the air, deep to left field, all the way back. Brown, he's near the wall. He jumps. That's gone.
There you go.
Jose Abreu's first home run as an Astro, and he's sprinting around the bases like he has never hit one before. He is going to fly into home plate.
That's right. The drought is finally over. The home run-less streak is finally over for Jose Abreu, and it comes on a day when the Astros, I believe, tied a franchise record in home runs hit in the game with 7 home runs to sweep the Oakland A's. And if you don't realize yet, there's no Payne and Pendergast on this Memorial Day. Instead, this is kind of an H-Town Hoops podcast edition of the Payne and Pendergast show. Brandon Scott here with you, Adam Spillane here with you, and Ben Geary handling things behind the scenes. Adam Spillane, how are you doing on this Memorial Day, my man?
I'm good. A lot of home runs yesterday. And they could have had 2 more. The balls that Corey Jolks hit one in the 9th, and then Bregman hit one earlier in the game, and they both would have been home runs at Minute Maid.
Yeah.
We've kind of seen this all year, the A's are really bad. I mean, that's not a Major League Baseball team. You could also argue that they would not win the Pacific Coast League. I mean, they are really bad. That team is, what, they're at 10 wins, and we are more than a third of the way through the season. I mean, they might not get to 40 wins this season. Like, that is in play.
I was having so much fun watching the power, and like you said, there were a couple of balls. First of all, Corey Jolks, by the way, is somebody who hits the ball just as hard as anybody not named Yordan Alvarez or maybe Kyle Tucker on the team. Kind of quiet as kept. But I was going to ask you about this at some point, and you mentioned it here to lead off, so I'll just get into it. But did you feel like we learned more about the Astros offense, or like they turned a corner, or was this more of a reflection of exactly who they were playing and just kind of taking advantage of the opponent?
That's an opponent thing. I think a lot of times it's an opponent thing. That team, it's just bad. Like, there are very few big leaguers that are on that roster, and any guys who should be big leaguers on that roster probably won't be there by the time the season ends. That's just how bad it is there. I remember Jose Altuve was doing his rehab games when he went to AA.
Yeah.
To do his rehab games, they were playing against Oklahoma City, the Dodgers affiliate, and Dusty Baker's just talking up, oh, that Oklahoma City, you know, that, it was Oklahoma City, so he's in AAA. That staff's really good. They got some really good guys. And I'm thinking the whole time, well, you know what's funny about what Dusty is saying is that the staff that he is facing right now in the minor leagues is probably better than the staff that he's going to be facing whenever he gets to the big leagues and he's facing Oakland, you know, when he makes his debut. That's how bad the A's are. They are going to wind up, it looks like, being historically bad. So I don't read a whole lot into the 3 games this past weekend, the 3 games before it, just because that team is lousy. But they're, you know, seeing Jose Abreu hit a home run was important.
Yeah.
Just you know, getting that lifted. And also, he almost hit one in the game on Friday.
Friday, yep.
So, I mean, that's a couple. You're trying to pick out small little things to at least make you believe that he's turning a corner. And I'm still not there. Like, there still are very few indicators that tell you that he is going to hit the way that they thought he would hit when they signed him last winter. But, I mean, yesterday's at least a start.
Yeah.
You know, seeing him with a hit, with a pull side hit that actually lands further than the infield, step in the right direction. That hasn't been happening very much. But the OPS still went down over the weekend. And I know it would have gone up had he been at Minute Maid in that ball on Friday's a home run. But the OPS went from 540 when he started the series to now it's 538 or 539 right now, and that's even with the homer yesterday.
Yeah, I don't feel like we can really overstate how big of a deal this is that he's not performing, and then it feels like it's overstated when he does perform. You know, it's like, whoa, he hit one to the warning track. I even tweeted that night on Friday night. I was watching at a bar, and I'm like, close, so close, he almost made it. And like you mentioned, I'm pretty sure that one would have actually been a home run at Minute Maid Park. So it's just kind of the luck there. But, I mean, this is a big deal with Jose Abreu and how little he's produced. I mean, he's been the least productive first baseman, and at least as a whole, and he's played pretty much every game except one or two, I think, at first base for them this year. As a whole, they've been the least productive at first base in terms of run creation, OPS, all of that. Like, they really need something to turn with him. And so, to me, that's why that was just such a big deal. And the part about him running – sprinting around the bases, I think, was just a testament to how much they realize how badly he's been struggling.
Yeah, and you saw the way his teammate celebrated in the dugout, and you know they all like him. Like he's really well liked. He's been well liked everywhere he's gone. But like you said, it doesn't take away from the fact that he has essentially been the worst player in baseball. Yeah. And that gets highlighted by the contract. Because it's one thing to be the worst player in baseball if you're making the league minimum.
Yeah.
It's another thing to be one of the highest paid players in all the sport. And, you know, when you're making $19.5 million and you're the worst player in the sport and you've got two more years after this, that's where it becomes a problem.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's the first year of the deal. Mm-hmm. So it's fresh. It's new. He's on a new team. And obviously he's on a World Series champion team, too. It's not like, you know, it's not like the Angels went and signed Anthony Rendon and nobody's paying attention to the Angels. This is a relevant baseball team, and so he's got to pick it up. But Abreu's not the only Jose who hit his first home run of the season yesterday.
Six in his last two starts, and do we have another one? Altuve makes a bid to left field. That ball's gone. Back-to-back jacks. Chaz McCormick and Jose Altuve with his first home run of 2023. And the Astros lead this game 6-1.
Crush City has arrived.
Yeah, that's Jeff Blum and Todd Callis on the call for AT&T Sportsnet. And they mentioned Crush City. It actually felt like it because, like we mentioned, they hit seven home runs. It felt like everybody got a home run, and the guys that didn't felt like they got close. But Jose Altuve, and we've been hitting on this quite a bit the last several days, or at least ever since Jose Altuve got back. It feels like that has just done so much for their lineup in terms of the flexibility of it, being able to move guys back. And then obviously just what Jose Altuve brings you at the top of the lineup. I mean, the power, the base running, all of that. And then he finally gets his home run. It's not there yet with Jose Altuve. It would be unreasonable to expect it to be. But I know they've got to feel good seeing Jose Altuve swing the bat like that on Sunday.
Yeah, he just gives them a dimension in that spot that they didn't have. And Mauricio Dubon played well. You know, let's not get, you know, I'm not going to try and tell you otherwise.
Yeah.
He did play well for them, but he's not nearly the same guy. He's not nearly the same guy as Jose Altuve. There's no power, you know, when he's out there in the leadoff spot. Altuve, he gives you that. You know, he can kind of give you a nice little jolt if you need it. And so just seeing him get at bats is important. And seeing him get his timing is important. And while the competition was not good this weekend, and he's facing just a terrible team and a terrible pitching staff in Oakland, and that's kind of been, you know, most of what he's played, six games, I guess, or he's played six games now against the A's, it's nice when you get to play a team like that. You know, that helps you, you know, it kind of probably, it's almost like an extension of the rehab assignment, just playing the A's. So yeah. it's a big positive. And he's only going to get better.
Right.
And I think that's the important part, is that this is kind of the baseline. This is kind of I still think that you would probably consider this to still be his spring training. So this is the baseline. And so you're just going to see him keep getting better. And I thought the one thing was interesting from Alex Bregman, when he took BP in Seattle for the first time, basically Bregman said, this is the best BP I've seen from him in a couple of years. And this is coming off of, you know, thumb surgery and not swinging the bat in, you know, a month and a half or whatever it was. So kind of tells you that Altuve is in a really good place right now.
All right. So for Astros fans, it had to be really good to see the team get on the right track. I called it a get right series going into it when I was on with Clint Sterner on Friday. And it was definitely that they get the sweep. They've been on a roll really for the last, I don't know, call it last couple of weeks or so. But we've got to discuss the pitching situation because there was a little bit of Lance McCullers news or non-news. And we'll remind you that the Astros are in the midst of a 17-game, 17-day stretch. So how are they going to deal with that with the pitching staff, with the rotation? Could we see a six-man rotation? Brandon Scott and Adam Spillane on a Memorial Day edition of Payne and Pendergast. We'll discuss that next.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
What up, y'all? It's your boy Danny Green, three-time NBA champ. You either rooted for me or rooted against me. Join myself and my co-host Harrison Sanford on the Inside the Green Room podcast.
It's a podcast that brings you never-before-told tales from the locker room to candid interviews with basketball legends to breakdowns of what's happening in the NBA right now. Whether you're a diehard fan or casual about your hoops, this podcast brings you the game like never before.
Follow Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This Memorial Day, we remember those who made the ultimate sacrifice for our freedom.
In for Payne and Pendergast,
here's Brandon Scott and Adam Spillane on Sports Radio 610.
All right, man. I can dig that. Didn't have to introduce ourselves this time. All right, like we did the last time. As the big voice guy said, it's Brandon Scott and Adam Spillane in here for Payne and Pendergast on a Memorial Day edition. We're coming off an Astros 10-1 victory over the Oakland Athletics on Sunday. And they swept the A's pretty handedly, as Adam and I were just talking about in the previous segment. That is barely a Major League Baseball team, if you want to even call it that. It's only probably technically a Major League Baseball team in the sense that they play Major League Baseball games. But when you look at that roster, it leaves a lot to be desired. And credit to the Astros for taking advantage of it this weekend. Very important that they do so, especially as the Rangers were playing against one of the better teams in baseball in the Baltimore Orioles, and they lost on Sunday, allowing the Astros to come within two games of the Rangers in the AL West, and they're probably going to be battling that thing out for quite a bit. But the Astros are in the thick of, or I should say in the beginning of, they just started a 17-game, 17-day stretch, which means they'll play 17 games without any days off, which leads you to the question of, hey, is a six-man rotation in play? Could they think about this? Is this something that they could consider? Something that they've done in the past, we've seen them do and have some success with at various times, and now might be a good time to do it, especially when you consider the makeup of their rotation, what they've lost, what they're missing. Obviously, Luis Garcia out for the season with Tommy John. Lance McCullers Jr., we're still trying to figure that whole situation out. Adam, where are you at right now on how they should manage this pitching staff going into this 17-day, 17-game stretch? I know we're, I guess, three games into it. And what the hell's going on with Lance McCullers?
Yeah, the six-man rotation is not a bad idea, and they've had success with it now the last couple of years. And it's a really good way to just give your guys an extra day. You know, give your starting pitchers an extra day off. Dusty Baker, I don't think, was a big fan of it at first because it leaves you a man short in the bullpen. But if your starters are really good, then, hey, it doesn't matter. You know, you're not quite as, you know, you don't need to lean on your bullpen quite as much. The problem comes, like, the theory is great. Hey, let's go to a six-man rotation. It works if you have six starters.
Yeah.
It does not work if you don't have six starters.
Do they?
And well, I don't know. Because you mentioned the guys that are out. Jose Urquidy's also out. Oh, that's a big loss.
Oh my God, dude, I forgot about Jose Urquidy.
So you were already, you know, you already had a little bit of an issue with the depth within the rotation coming into the season after McCullers got hurt. And then as guys started falling and you lost two guys on back-to-back days, with Urquidy and Garcia, that really puts you in a bind, and you don't really have anybody in AAA either. I mean, you look, they brought up JP France, they've brought up Brandon Bielak. That's essentially their starting pitching depth right there. Forrest Whitley got shut down again, had to leave. He left his last start after 52 pitches with a lat injury, so he's going to be down for some time. And so now, if you do want to go to a six-man rotation, you're looking at going with maybe Ronel Blanco, who has essentially been converted to a starter as we speak. That doesn't seem like the best option, but if you're trying to get through a full 162-game season plus an extra month with October, you might not have a choice. So for somebody like Blanco, he's going to have to learn how to be a starting pitcher on the fly, it seems like, unless they go outside the organization to get somebody. Because like you brought up with McCullers, it doesn't seem like he's anywhere close to contributing at the major league level right now. I mean, he was supposed to throw. I mean, he felt pain in his elbow or forearm, whatever it was, during spring training, like that first week of spring training. He had started to rehab. He had started to, you know, take the steps needed to get to a rehab assignment. And then last weekend, it looked like he was going to start facing hitters. He was going to throw a live BP last Saturday. And then for whatever reason, he did not throw that live BP last Saturday. They said, oh, you know, he's going to throw a bullpen on Sunday. He did not throw that bullpen either. And Astros general manager Dana Brown was on the pregame show yesterday and basically saying that he's light tossing on flat ground.
Yeah.
So that would indicate that McCullers had some sort of a setback. The team, for whatever reason, will not, like, you know, spell this stuff out. You kind of have to read between the lines. But the fact that he is not doing any sort of, like, intensive throwing on flat ground tells you that he is a long way off, it seems like. Because, you know, he hadn't even faced hitters. And you look at kind of the timeline that he was on last year, he made four rehab starts in the minor leagues. And it's not like he's going from facing hitters one day to making his first minor league start the next day. No, it's a very long process that you have to go through. It's basically his spring training as well. And so it just doesn't seem like he is anywhere close to pitching.
This doesn't even feel like reading between the lines. It just feels like, and maybe it is reading between the lines, but it just feels like piecing it all together. I mean, he's on the mound, then he's on flat ground. That, to me, is just like basic math of going backwards, especially when you're supposed to be progressing towards something. We're not just talking about training. We're talking about training to get ready for the season, to ramp up for the season. He's still got to go through what would essentially be his spring training exercises and what that would look like, what that would entail. And we haven't even gotten there yet. I mean, we're past a week now of supposed to be that live BP. And we were just talking about it in the break. The guy hasn't even faced live pitching. You mentioned Blanco. Does it work with him as, like, I don't know how viable of an option that actually is, or maybe it's just the fact that they won't have to do it for that long of a period of a time. But you were just hitting on this a moment ago as well. It seems like more than likely they're going to have to either go outside of the organization or get really creative with how they manage these guys.
The problem with going with a six-man rotation now is that you're limited by how many pitchers you can actually carry on the roster, because MLB limits that. You know, MLB says that you can only have 13 pitchers. So most teams, well, right now the Astros have an 8-man bullpen. You go to a 6-man rotation, all of a sudden that bullpen shrinks by a man. And that's not like, it was fine last year. It worked out fine last year because their starting pitchers were all really good. But when you do this, and let's say you have one of the starters has a short outing, you know, for whatever reason, he can't get out of the third. Well, now all of a sudden, that's when your bullpen starts to get upside down. And if it happens, let's say the next day, well, then things are really in a tenuous spot because you don't have an off day. You know, you don't have any off days. So now all of a sudden, your bullpen is really pitching from behind and you're really stretching things out with that staff. And so that's the danger of a six-man rotation. And last year, you could do it. You know, when your worst starting pitcher essentially is Jose Urquidy last year, hey, go ahead and do the six-man rotation. But now you're essentially, if they go with the six-man rotation, you are looking at having three guys in that six-man rotation who are either in the minor leagues to start the year or in the Astros bullpen to start the year. That doesn't seem all that conducive to being successful. It could, because JP France has pitched well and since he's been up, and Brandon Bielak's been pretty good since he's been up. But man, it's you don't have that same depth. And then, hey, what if another guy gets hurt? Because as we've seen, starting pitchers are very, very fragile. And you also have to wonder with Hunter Brown, who they've said, he's on a bit of an innings limit right now, too. So they got to be careful with him. So they're in a really tough spot with the starting rotation, something that really has not been an issue for them for the last, what, season and a half.
Scott Boris, the super agent, he has a couple clients on the Astros, you might know. He was on a podcast, an Odyssey podcast, not too long ago called Baseball Isn't Boring, suggesting that, man, maybe the pitch clock is having to do with some fatigue and some injuries, and maybe the league should have considered expanding rosters. Do you think Major League Baseball should expand rosters and add pitchers to the rotation, or you think this is Scott Boras politicking a little bit?
That's Scott Boras wanting to get more guys big league jobs. That's all that is. No, I don't think that any starting pitching, you know, you can go bring up the World Baseball Classic as a reason why some of these guys are getting, I don't know. I think that I can't imagine, and I don't know this. I don't know if this is a fact, but it does not seem like that pitchers are getting hurt at a higher rate this year because of the pitch clock than they have in years past. It's that pitchers get hurt because they are throwing as hard as humanly possible, and a human arm isn't supposed to be able to do that. So, no, I don't buy into the pitch clock at all as a reason for some pitcher injuries.
Yeah, with a pitcher, it's not a matter of if you're going to get hurt or if your elbow or shoulder arm is going to give out on you. It's just a matter of when.
Yeah.
Right? That's just kind of the physics of it all.
It's a ticking time bomb.
Absolutely. All right, guys. Yesterday was a Houston sports anniversary, and Adam Spillane and I both lived it in real time. We're going to relive it here on the radio with y'all. We're going to try not to make it too sad about it. That's next on Sports Radio 610.
This Memorial Day, we remember those who made the ultimate sacrifice for our freedom.
In for Payne and Pendergast,
here's Brandon Scott and Adam Spillane on Sports Radio 610.
Coming up on a minute remaining. Rockets by one. Shot clock to five. Paul guarded by Cook. Paul on the spin. Rebound three. 50 seconds to go.
Chris Paul is down. Chris Paul is hurt. He's not going to come out the game. He did not pass half court on that last play, knowing it was a desperation play. He is hurt. Going to have to take Chris Paul off of the court. Well, they might have to drag him because you know he's not going to come off the court.
You might wonder, why are Brandon Scott and Adam Spillane playing a five-year-old injury? Why are we reliving the Chris Paul hamstring injury from that was game five? But that it's because that's the precipice for game seven. That set the stage for the rest of that series. And as you guys know, it's Memorial Day. It's Monday. We were not on the air yesterday, but yesterday marked a very special occasion, a very special anniversary. And depending on how you look at it, if you're a Rockets fan, it could be glass half full, glass half empty. But the way I look at it is, it's the last time when I felt like the Rockets had a legitimate chance to go to the championship and win it, to go to the NBA Finals and actually win it. Now, it's a little bit presumptuous to think that had they not blown the 3-2 series lead against the Golden State Warriors in 2018, that they too could have swept the Cleveland Cavaliers or some, and you know, beat them in some sort of fashion. Maybe a little bit presumptuous, but I think at the time most people felt like those were the two best teams in the NBA. But it didn't go down like that, and history was changed forever or altered forever. My man Adam Spillane was in the building for that, and here we are 5 years later with the Rockets feeling so far away from that moment that it's just hard to believe. And we're doing that, you know, here we are on a night where, you know, we're going to find an Eastern Conference finalist tonight, you know, an NBA finalist, I should say. We already have our Eastern Conference finalist, but an NBA finalist tonight. And it sure would be nice to be covering something like that, to be around something like that, to have that kind of energy around here. I know that had to been a hell of a time for you, Adam, covering the Rockets in that particular time period.
Yeah, they were really good. That was a really good team. It was a really together team. I think they for sure would have won the finals had they been able to get through that series. So I did think, though, the next year they also had a chance to, you know.
Yeah, as a four seed you did.
Yeah, especially after Durant got hurt. You know, game five, I think that they would tell you that they probably should have won that series. So,
yeah,
they probably should have won that series ahead of the game, 18 was obviously the tougher one for them to win, especially once Paul got hurt in game five. But then 19 is the one that they should have won once Durant did get hurt. The Rockets were healthy in that series. So it was two really good years for them.
Yeah, and I was going to think about it too. Like maybe next year could mark the five-year anniversary of when they failed to capitalize on Kevin Durant's injury, because you're right about that. I mean, I know that was the – I mean, that's the semifinals and, you know, you're the four seed and all of that.
Portland was not – that was not a real Western Conference.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah. Totally fair. And so that's another missed opportunity, another opportunity that seemed like they didn't seize. But I think it's because of the previous year that almost kind of conditioned me for that. Like the disappointment of watching that Chris Paul injury and watching them, you know, go up to Golden State. And that was just a special, that game six in Golden State was a special Clay and Steph game, really mostly Clay, but a special game for them. And so you figured that coming home, game seven, trip to the finals on the line. And I got to be honest with you, man. There was a moment in the first quarter. I don't know. There's a lot of basketball to be played. You don't want to start making too many assumptions in the first quarter. But when this happened in the first quarter, I really thought that the Rockets might have had it.
Off the steal. Harden comes across against Thompson. Thompson played well against Harden the other day after the catch of that. That counts on the foul. It's a three-pointer. Plus the foul on Thompson, his third.
Well, Steve Kerr going to be able to gamble?
I mentioned that one, Adam, and that's James Harden hitting a three and one over Klay Thompson early in the first quarter to give the Rockets an early lead. But, you know, that game is sort of synonymous with the three-point drought, or how many did they miss? 27, 0 for 27 of the 27 streak. It's almost like you forget earlier in the game. They actually did hit a couple of threes, and they actually did – seemed to start the game off pretty well. And so I don't know, man, like where was it for you as somebody that was there? Where did you feel like the game really swung, or where could you really kind of feel like, oh, you know what? Like, when did you guys start to notice they haven't hit a lot of threes in a while?
You know, I don't remember when I noticed that per se. Obviously you knew that they weren't hitting shots, but it kind of, I think they were up by 10 or 11 at halftime of that game. And it felt like this wasn't sustainable. Like, that was the read that I had just in the arena, because they were having to play so hard and exert so much energy just to have that lead, and a 10 or 11 point lead with the Warriors, especially was that nothing. Warriors. Yeah. It's,
yeah. You know, especially at that time.
That's a 2 minute run for them. And so you never felt, and you didn't feel great about it anyways, even coming into it, because you didn't have CP and they were basically a man short. And that's kind of what it turned out to be. And you look at how that series played out just in the, you know, the five games before, the first five games, where the Rockets were basically playing seven guys. It was going to be the five starters, Harden, Paul, Ariza, Tucker, Capella, and then two guys off the bench. It was Gordon, and then it was Gerald Green. And that was a fine, you know, yeah. Gerald Green is kind of the seventh man. That kind of worked out for them. But what you lost with Paul is that now all of a sudden you had to replace those minutes.
Yeah.
And they could not replace those minutes. And that's really what hurt them more than anything else. And so everybody, you know, everybody moves up a spot, and now all of a sudden you're trying to fill 40 minutes. And that game, they kind of tried out Ryan Anderson, and that's where things really, that's where the game was lost.
Yeah.
And they just really didn't have, you know, they just didn't really have any other options. And so Ryan Anderson in that game plays 8 minutes. The Rockets were minus 12 in those 8 minutes. And the Warriors saw Ryan Anderson on the floor, and they just attacked him at will with Steph Curry. And they involved Ryan. You know, they knew the Rockets were going to switch. And so they just made sure to get Steph Curry on Ryan Anderson as much as humanly possible. And they made the Rockets pay for it. And I think that as we look back at that, probably the Rockets lost that series, not in game seven. They probably lost that series game 81 of the regular season when Luke Bamute hurt his shoulder in L.A.
Yeah.
Because if that doesn't happen, then all of a sudden that rotation is a little bit deeper. And the Rockets tried to play Luke Bamute in that series, especially early, and he just wasn't up to it. You know, yeah. Offensively, he could not do anything. I think he was 2 of 13 or something like that, and he just missed layup after layup after layup, and he just was unplayable for them. And so they had to roll the dice with Anderson, and Anderson just couldn't do anything. And that, I think, ultimately is why they lost that game and lost that series.
Yeah, you mentioned Gerald Green early. He cooked a little bit in game five. I was going back and watching and was really impressed with Gerald Green. I don't think I forgot, but it was a nice little reminder. But, yeah, man, Ryan Anderson, he was getting caught on switches with Steph Curry, and he was, like, I mean, putting him in a blender. Luke Bamute, that's another one. Like, I looked up in game six, I think it was, and he was out there in garbage time. Like, and I was like, wait, you know what? He was a relevant player for them, but
they were trying to basically get him to catch a rhythm. Yeah. Like, that was basically what that was about, was that they knew, all right, they knew it was, they weren't going to say it, but they pretty much knew Chris Paul wasn't playing.
Yeah.
In the rest of that series. So you're trying as in, and they were up 17 in game six. Like, that's the other forgotten part. And they just got killed in the third quarter. They were outscored by 17 points in the third quarter of game six. They were outscored by 18 points in the third quarter of game seven. And that's really where that series turned. But yeah, they were just trying to catch a rhythm with that guy, just to see if he could be playable in game seven, because they knew they were going to need somebody for that game. And he just wasn't up to it. And so they tried with Anderson. And, you know, when you're missing 27 straight three pointers, having Ryan Anderson out on the floor can probably help that. And he just couldn't. And so that was a mistake of an offseason of signing him in the first place.
Yeah.
That was a really bad contract, as it turned out. And when they needed him most, he didn't come through.
Well, a couple of off seasons later, they ended up trading Chris Paul to the Oklahoma City Thunder for Russell Westbrook. And the domino effect of that was that they eventually, midway through that season, that following season, would have to trade Clint Capella, because they could not have two guys who couldn't shoot on the floor at the same time, who playing as many minutes as those two guys were playing.
They chose not to.
And I could kind of see why. I understood it. But with this series and going down memory lane, what it made me remember was how nice of a pick and roll lob threat that Clint Capella was in his time here. This was in the first half as the Rockets were building that lead.
Warriors need a timeout, and Houston is chasing a double-digit lead.
And then, Adam, I was pretty sure that the Rockets were going to go to the finals. I don't know, and this was the emotion to me, mind you. I wasn't with you at this time, right? I'm not at the arena. I'm in the KHOU newsroom cheering on with, you know, some other folks in the newsroom, because there's no cheering in the press box, but nobody's watching us in the newsroom. So we're like, you know, we're doing that kind of corny local news root for the team thing that you do. And we're into it, man. We're into it. And when this happens, I'm like, hey, man, this might be destiny.
On the back top, it's kept alive by his face stolen by Harden. By 15.
But as you mentioned, man, it just kind of craters from there. That's the Rockets by 15 in the second quarter. But as you mentioned, the third quarter was not kind to them. You know, the Warriors had a knack for really beating teams in the third quarter. I know Klay Thompson built a reputation off of his performance in the third quarter. But yeah, man, that is just a time, I feel like, that the Rockets now are so desperately trying to get back to a moment like that, where they feel like, hey, they are this close to being a champion. I think about it like this, like, you're not going to always feel like you're a finals contender, but you want to at least feel like you have a team that could go to the conference finals, could go to the conference championship game, could go to the ALCS or NLCS if you're rooting for a National League team. And so I feel like that was maybe the last moment for me when I thought they're going to win the championship, because the third quarter happens not long after that. And, you know, by the end of the game, I realized, hey, they went 27 three-point tries without hitting a single one.
Yeah, and, you know, they did what they could. And yeah, that's the problem. That was the problem with facing the Warriors back then, and I guess it still is kind of a problem, is that they just wear you down. And they were just, they just had nothing left. And I remember, you know, one of the things that, one of the more distinct memories from that day is normally when I go back down below, I'm going towards the visitor side, but because I was sitting in a different part of the arena, I was going down through the hallway that connects the floor to the Rockets locker room.
Okay.
And it was just dead silent. I've never heard it that quiet down there before. And so that's one of the things that I'll never forget about just that day, is just how quiet it was from the tunnel where the Rockets leave the floor to it, towards the locker room. And there you just, you could hear a, you could hear a pin drop. That's how quiet it was in that building. Just being in the locker room, it was the same way. It was a tough night because they put so much into it. They really did. And everything that they had done going into that, into that series and into that game was, that whole season was about beating the Warriors, and they had them. They really did have them. They had two shots to take them out. They were missing their second best player in doing so, but they still thought they could get it done, and they were close. They were 24 minutes away from doing it, not once, but twice.
I don't like to be this guy or that guy, Adam. I really don't. And I think everybody falls into it, and you can be critical of officiating. It doesn't necessarily make you that guy. But I hate to be the fan who's like, clearly biased in favor of the team he's rooting for, and so like hammers the officiating. But if I'm honest, man, another thing that I remember about that game was feeling like it was poorly, poorly officiated. And here is Exhibit A.
Harden. He was looking for a foul on Bell. Mike D'Antoni upset
and should have gotten it. I mean, you got to protect the shooter. We saw this all in Game 6 and already one here in Game 7.
Call for a second.
You tell me if there's any contact here.
Yes.
Yes.
And the airspace up under also. He got fouled up top and up under.
Man, that's Chris Webber at the time with TNT saying that the rookie, was that Jordan Bell, fouls James Harden up top and on the bottom. About a little less than 4 minutes left to go in the second quarter. The Rockets at that point had a double-digit lead and nothing. Like, nothing. I couldn't believe it. I thought, yo, how is that not a foul that's so clearly contact? And that wasn't it.
They are in their grill.
Here's Harden. Way off.
Another foul he should have gotten.
Thompson. Yes.
6-point swing right there.
This is the second three in which Bell gets his arm. That's not his swipe through. This is Game 7. That's 6 points you lead on the line. Every possession matters.
And as you hear there, Chris Webber is noting that it happened twice, and he's passionate about it. He has no connection to the Rockets, no skin in the game, so to speak. But noticing that, hey, you know, this doesn't quite seem right. And look, man, honestly, it happened again, but this time we talked about the third quarter, rough time for the Rockets. Well, they were going against the officiating a little bit as well.
But he's fouled by Thompson, who picked up number four.
I think this is a shot.
This is the third call that he's missed.
I think this is good.
This is the third, yes. He was already into his shooting motion.
He would normally shoot this, though. But this is gonna counter him.
That's when Harden gives him the little okie doke, does a little hezzy, gets him the reach, and then goes up for the shot. He had been doing that all year. That felt like a playoff call, like a call that seemed like it was called differently in the playoffs than it had been all year. But talk about the Rockets not hitting any threes. He hit that one. They just didn't call it. I don't know how you felt at that moment or what you saw at that moment, but it just seemed like there were some opportunities there that were left on the floor. And you don't want to be that guy that blames officiating, but damn it, man, it seemed like they got really unlucky that night.
Well, that's where the term Scott Foster bleep job was born. And they didn't bleep it. I tell you, the team doesn't bleep it. They say the full thing, but you know, that's what they believed. And you saw that when they leaked the whole, whatever it was, the officiating thing that, you know, the next year. I mean, they felt like they were robbed of that series from an organizational standpoint. I didn't really feel it, to be honest with you. I didn't feel it necessarily at the game. Officials miss calls all the time. That's how they were officiated most of the year. And the Rockets were a benefit. Benefited from a lot of calls throughout the course of that season. James Harden did as well. And so, you know, that's just how it goes sometimes. I mean, they got outplayed in essence in the second half. You know, you get outscored by 18 in the third quarter. It wasn't all on call. So I'm not the right person to ask about it, but I do know that the term Scott Foster bleep job was born that
day. I'll tell you this. I know this about you because I do a basketball podcast with you. You watch a lot of basketball. And so I'm going to ask you honestly, man, have you ever in your life seen a more blatant moving screen than this from the rookie Bell that didn't get called?
Yeah. All you have to do is call it like you see it. That's a moving screen.
This Weber sees it.
The poise of Golden State. They don't care. They're just fighting for it.
But that's what happens in a game seven.
Yeah.
In a game seven, you're just not going to call that much. And you can go look, and I don't know, I should have maybe looked at this ahead of time, but if you look in a game seven at just the number of free throws that are shot in a game seven compared to every other game, it's probably a really big difference because the officials don't want to involve themselves that much. And so you're noticing that for the most part, these are all whistles that weren't blown. It's not like they were bad. It's not like they were fouls that weren't fouls. They were just called. It's basically, hey, roll the ball out, play, and decide it yourselves. We're not going to get involved. That's kind of the way I think that officials look at game sevens. I'm guessing you will see the same thing tonight. I don't know who the referees are tonight, but my guess is Scott Foster, who worked game seven 5 years ago, he will probably work game seven tonight in Boston.
That was the Rockets 5 years ago. Hopefully sometime within the next 5 years, we're talking about them being in a similar situation. But coming up, the Astros just beat up on one of baseball's very worst teams. How do they stack up against the best? That's next on Sports Radio 610.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
What up, y'all? It's your boy Danny Green, 3-time NBA champ. You either rooted for me or rooted against me. Join myself and my co-host Harrison Sanford on the Inside the Green Room podcast.
It's a podcast that brings you never-before-told tales from the locker room to candid interviews with basketball legends to breakdowns of what's happening in the NBA right now. Whether you're a diehard fan or casual about your hoops, this podcast brings you the game like never before.
Follow Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.